I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Online sales rose 15% last year, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. About 9 cents of every dollar spent at retail is now spent online. In this hour, how do you decide when to shop online and when to shop in a brick-and-mortar store? Are there certain items you have to see in person before you make a purchase? Sylvia Long-Tolbert, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, gives us insight into consumer behavior and how stores are fighting to hold our attention. Plus, how are malls adapting to the rise of online shopping? Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal updates us on development in our region, including the trend to open-air plazas. It's midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us. Today we're going to talk about shopping. Take a moment. What was the last purchase you made? Not food, but clothing, books, a laptop, or some other product. Maybe you got an email from your favorite clothing shop and logged on this morning to buy something. Maybe you went to a shopping center to do some grocery shopping and walked a few doors over to the shoe store. There are a lot of factors that affect how and when we shop. In the age of the smartphone, you can shop easily on the go and even compare prices while inside a store. Rewards cards and apps alert us to sales and coupons. Long after stores close for the night, you can go online and fill up your shopping cart. In the face of these options, stores and malls have had to change. While some industry experts estimate that one-third of enclosed malls are dead or dying, some malls are fighting back. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the trend toward town center or open-air plaza style that is helping traditional malls adapt. With me today to discuss retail development is our former Midday producer, Melody Simmons. She's now real estate reporter, covers real estate and development for the Baltimore Business Journal. Welcome back to Midday.
Thank you. It's so great to be back.
It's great to have you back. And also here with us, is Sylvia Long-Tolbert, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. Professor Tolbert is an expert on consumer behavior, marketing research, and strategic brand management. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
Have you noticed changes at malls and shopping centers in your neighborhood? Are there certain items that you prefer to buy in person and others that you buy online? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from you. Professor Tolbert, what factors play into whether we shop in person, online, on the phone, on our desktops?
I think we still are looking at people focused on utilitarian needs. What do I need to stay functional, remain functional, or pursue other life-based or social-centered activities? The other part would be very much social, which we see as really evolving into integration between the cell phone and how we spend our lives, people telling you to go look, go see. So it's very experiential and impromptu.
Okay, I'm having a hard time putting those two things together. Very practical, but experiential and social.
And very impromptu and spontaneous. And that's where the smartphone and the internet has dramatically changed the purchase decision-making process. We no longer think about shopping in terms of discrete decision-making. It's a journey, and it's continuous and ongoing. So we're constantly looking at posts about people's recent purchases, hitting the like button, adding things to a wish list, adding things to a shopping cart for us to come back at a later time when we think we might be in the market. So it's a continuous journey, whereas in the past we would sit and think about it in a more linear way. What do I need? Talk to other people, do an information search, then evaluate my options and determine whether now is the time to buy. That's no longer the case. People are bombarded by so much information 24/7 that we see people making decisions in the moment. We see people really consciously making decisions about what brands will be in their consideration set once they're in the market. That could be 2 days later, a month later, a year later, but we've already given some level of conscious thought to what we might buy and what criteria are important to a purchase decision along the way. So we see that as one of the fundamental changes in where the internet and access to information has dramatically changed the need for utilitarian purchases, and then those that may be more experiential because the search is more social. It includes feedback and input from other people, and it doesn't mean that we're about to make a decision, but we like to feel informed because the information is there.
This is so interesting to me because as I listen to you, I realize I'm stuck back in the kind of shopping that you say is not current in doing a search for a particular product and in thinking of this purchase and then that purchase.
Sure.
as opposed to all this. But you've touched on something I want to ask you both about, and that is when I look at the numbers from the Commerce Department, 9% of retail sales are online. That's not nothing, but to hear all the buzz around online shopping, I would expected a bigger number. I mean, are you seeing, Melody, as you cover development and real estate, that brick and mortar retailers are, do they feel they're up against something in online shopping?
They definitely do. There is a big push going on right now to kind of counter that trend that we're seeing about online shopping, shopping at all hours. And what that is that the brick and mortar stores are trying to make shopping a more personal, more attractive experience for the shoppers. The malls are changing. It's not the big old mall anymore. It is a smaller, more intimate marketplace where you can drive right up to the front of the store, park your car, go in, get what you need, and leave. Or you can go get lunch or dinner in kind of a town center Main Street-like atmosphere. This is all being tweaked to kind of make shopping, to continue to make shopping more of a personal experience rather than sitting one-on-one with a computer screen.
But Professor Talbert, I'm still hung up on 9%. I mean, am I forgetting that it's a moving target and it's 9% now, but it's clearly on the upswing? Or why is that so important to retailers?
I think what Melanie has underscored a very important point here. It's very experiential, and there's plenty of data to support that people are no longer vested in buying manufactured goods and products and tangible things. What they're investing in is the experience, and that's where the physical retail environment still has an advantage. And from a consumer behavior perspective, we like to think about the sensory experience, the level of personalization, the lighting, the atmospherics, and then also inside the store, you get yet another social dimension that you can't recreate online. You can read and kind of sense how other people are feeling. But when you enter the store, all of your sensory outlets become activated by the lighting, the people, the smells. The experience itself is what people are really more interested, invested in. And you can't underestimate the need to sense, see, and touch and feel many products, because in the world that we currently live in, price transparency has reduced one advantage. So the next issue is quality.
I'm sorry. I want to make sure I understand that. Price transparency, which is to say we can check online,
yes,
we can do comparison shopping.
Yes.
You said has reduced one transparency. I thought that's what
it's
I heard you say.
Price transparency has kind of reduced one dimension of competitiveness.
Oh.
So you can see the price everywhere. You can monitor it and know that there is a good deal there monetarily. But what you don't know is whether the quality and the other aspects of the product, good, or service is going to live up to your expectations. And I think that becomes a untapped space for competitiveness or some type of advantage to the stores. Because buying your milk at Whole Foods is very different than buying your milk at Mom's. They create two very different experiences selling the same natural and or organic products, but you're getting something different at each one. And that you can't recreate online. And so people who want to feel the sensory pulse of their purchases or want to socialize or engage with personnel around what makes this product more organic than another one, how do I know that this is the best value, those conversations can be had, and people's confidence in their purchase decisions can be enacted in the store, whereas it doesn't naturally happen online.
At Sylvia Long Talbert, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey School of Business, an expert on consumer behavior, marketing research, and brand management. Here on Midday on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Melody Simmons, real estate and development reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. Melody, I think you were about to make a point.
Well, I think Sylvia made a great point, and that is about the grocery experience, because besides the consumer products of, you know, a new sweater or a new pair of shoes, new pocketbook buying online, there was a launch to try to sell groceries online, and it really had high hopes. It never has taken off because I think that there is a personal experience. Let me see that green pepper. Let me see the shrimp. I think the consumer likes to go into the grocery store and buy that way, buy their groceries that way. So the grocery shopping has never really taken off, and grocery stores are better off for it.
Yeah, but it is, I'll call it the green pepper experience. Is that essentially more true of more items that are not perishable? In other words, are people looking to have that experience even if they ultimately are going to buy online?
I think so. When you think about, we've moved to an economy where people are more selective and frugal in how they spend their money. Purchase decisions take on more importance in terms of not the amount of time it takes to make a decision, but people don't want post-purchase regret. So if you're able to anchor your thinking and your knowledge about what quality represents in a particular shopping context, then you may find going back online to shop for the best deals or to look for new variety, then is something that the internet or the smartphone becomes useful. But oftentimes, I think people want to be assured that there's value in the ultimate purchase. It goes back to that other experience. You think about the millennials who make investments in designer bags that cost a couple of $1,000s.
Yeah, this is a mystery to me.
Yeah. But the brand ensures the integrity of the product. If it's Burberry and it's distributed solely at Burberry's website, you have some degree of confidence that you're getting the real thing. But guess what happens when a millennial finally gets the $3,000 to buy the Burberry bag? They take their friends, they go to the store, they ooh and ah. They have they don't call them salespeople, but I don't know the appropriate term at this point. But they have the in-store personnel create an experience around this moment. It's a defining moment, the purchase itself. So this is where you see retail stores really stepping it up to make sure that once you've pulled the plug, the buy decision, you've made the buy decision, that there isn't any post-purchase regret. And completing it and filling it out with the in-store customized personnel interactions and all of the other value dimensions that come from the social buying experience, which a lot of people are very interested in today, is worthwhile. And the reason you see the retail store front still serves a very important role.
Yeah, this is exactly the opposite of what we tend to hear a lot about people checking out products in stores and then going online to try to find a better price.
I think we're kind of in a, we're in the changeover period right now. There's a lot of old habits bumping up against the new habits. You have generational issues towards shopping. And so this is where we're at right now because the internet's taken over. There's so many people buying online anymore and also in person. So this is where the confusion comes in for the developers to try to stay ahead of the trend, try to build brick and mortar stores or a brick and mortar experience that can rival shopping online. As Sylvia said, just to see it, to touch it, have a little celebration when you buy your $3,000 pocketbook. It's very unusual. We're just in a whole new period of shopping.
We need to take a quick break here. There's lots more to talk about. We'll get an update on mall redevelopment in our region. We'll look at malls in the city and Baltimore and Howard counties. How are they adapting to changing customer habits? You can join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Are there new shopping centers in your neighborhood? Do you find yourself shopping in person for certain items and online for other items? Give us a call, 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. We're discussing the factors that influence how and when we shop and how malls in our region are adapting to changing consumer habits. In studio with me is Sylvia Long-Tolbert, consumer marketing expert from the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, and Melody Simmons, who covers real estate for the Baltimore Business Journal. Do you give yourself a budget for online shopping and a different budget to shop in store? Do you window shop in store and then go online? Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or call us at 410-662-8780. So, Melody, you've been chronicling a lot of shopping centers in our region, sprucing up, changing things. What? Paint a picture for us.
Well, there's a lot of conversion going on right now. We'll start with Owings Mills. We'll start out in the suburbs. The Owings Mills Mall, a lot of people remember in January of 2015, the New York Times profiled that mall, said it had just become a dead mall, actually compared it to being something like a beached whale.
Right, so, and frightening pictures, really gloomy pictures.
Gloomy.
In that New York Times piece.
And so that's true. That's exactly right. That mall never took off. It started with a bang with Saks Fifth Avenue and some other high-end stores.
It started
stores.
About when?
It started in 86. It opened first time in 86. And the development around it really never kept up with the glamour of that mall. So over the years, it just lost its luster. Stores started closing. And actually, as of November, the last store closed. Right now, the area is in the middle of a really big conversion. They're not going to take the whole mall down, but they're going to redevelop it, and make it more of an outdoor shopping experience. And think along the lines of what you see at White Marsh on the Avenue. That is a kind of a Main Street shopping experience. There's ample parking. As I said, you could get right up near the stores where you want to go or the restaurant. That's what's popular right now. And they're going to try to convert Owings Mills to something along those lines as well. You're also seeing something similar to that at the Rotunda, which was a smaller
urban
mall right in the city. It has now flipped outwards, and you're going to see a courtyard with retail lining the courtyard. That should open beginning in the spring with Mom's Organic. A beautiful new store is going to open there, grocery, and then smaller retail inside on that inner courtyard experience. There are also 300 plus new apartments going up there. So if you live there, you can shop there, you can go to a movie there. You really don't. Once you're home, you're in.
But I hear you describe these, and I'm thinking, okay, so we're no longer going to have the malls, no matter how they're oriented, whether they're enclosed or oriented to the outside, with the big anchor stores, you know, the Macy's or the Nordstrom's, or the Macy's at one end and Sears at the other. That's not happening anymore?
Well, what we're seeing in terms of the retailing life cycle is that we're going to an omni-channel strategy. And what that means is that the shopping across all of these different platforms that you're mentioning is going to be seamless. So we can purchase the same items whether we're on the smartphone, whether we're on the internet at the store's website, or whether we're in the store. If by chance there is an inventory at any one of those places, you can automatically shop across channels so that it becomes a one-stop shopping regardless of the platform.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that retailers build a store building into their expectation that customers will come into that store on which they are paying rent and they are paying for electric lights and all the expense of a brick and mortar store, and they are expecting people right then in the store to shop online on their smartphone?
Absolutely. And they will be able to simulate the shopping experience and satisfy the buy decision at any customer touch point. So it's no longer
satisfy the buy decision.
Yeah, if you decide
scratch
at this
that
point
itch.
Yeah, if you decide. Yeah, it's the impulse. Everything now that we see from the consumer's perspective is about satisfying the need in the moment. And if your intent was to buy the yellow sweater, but you're in the store at lunchtime with colleagues and you decide the orange sweater is better, but it's not in your size, you can swap out that decision in the moment via your smartphone. And so we have to really build into the retail delivery channel that kind of flexibility if indeed you want to capture the buy decision and the customer as they make that decision. And that becomes very important. And so you will see that many retailers like Macy's are really investing a lot in this omni-channel strategy. So it means every shopping touch point has to look like you're in the retail store and can facilitate the purchase in that moment.
Okay, a couple of things. Well, first of all, just at a most basic level, I thought retailers lived and died by sales per square foot, that they needed to generate revenue per square foot. But the examples you're giving us, it sounds like the online, it may be that same retailer, but its online version is going to get the benefit of that sale in that square foot, and the retail store won't have anything to show for it. I mean, Melody, how do retailers figure out whether they're actually doing a good business?
I think they're trying to figure it out right now. I think that right now they're happy to say it goes into our bottom line. And they're looking at trends. They're looking at data. Right now in the Baltimore region, the largest growth in building is for a large warehouse space. And a lot of that is in the 95 corridor. It's on I-70. And a lot of these retailers are buying space in there because they are starting to plan for e-commerce. This is the deliver in a day. This is the deliver in an hour. We're seeing a lot of the companies move toward that as an offering to the consumer, that if you buy online, we'll have it to your house by the end of the day.
That is Melody Simmons here on Midday on WIPR. Melody covers real estate and development for the Baltimore Business Journal. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with us is Sylvia Long-Tolbert, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey School of Business. And you can be part of this conversation. What stores do you go to for experience of shopping? What malls and shopping centers do you think have a good balance of activities like dining or a movie theater as well as shopping? Do you like to browse and linger while shopping, or are you aiming to make your shopping as efficient as possible? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Dan in Baltimore is calling us. Dan, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to call in, especially after one of your guests' comments, you know, early on about the millennial buying, one of the most debt-ridden generations ever, buying a $3,000 handbag. I really hope someday soon Midday will do a segment on free exchanges and sharing commerce, especially in the city. I wanted to ask, though, your guests, what are their thoughts on less car-centric urban shopping center developments, whether it's Old Town Mall or something of that nature?
Dan, I appreciate both of your ideas. Send me an email, and we'll talk about free exchange as a possible separate conversation. But what about this, Melody?
Well,
development that's not car-centric.
Yeah, it's very much coming up in Baltimore. We're seeing it at Harbor East, where Sylvia works. You can see the circle right around there. There's a lot of high-end shops that have opened up, walkable, available on the circulator. If you look at Pratt Street, which is some have deemed Baltimore's new Main Street on the waterfront, there's a lot of retail there. There's Marshall's. There used to be a Best Buy, but there's not anymore. But there's a lot of pop-up shops that are coming up, as well as a lot of new restaurants. So there is a lot of walkable retail starting up. And in the proposal for the Newport Covington development, which was being unveiled as we speak in layers, there's a lot of pedestrian-friendly retail and office space. So in the next 20 years, as that is built up, that's going to be built on that model as well.
We got an email from Graham who says, my wife and I are millennials who live in Canton. We use Relay Foods to order our weekly groceries online and pick up our packaged order at a convenient location near us. All of the foods are sourced as locally as possible. We don't worry as much about the quality because it has always proved to be as good or better than the grocery store, but it's way more convenient. It also allows us to plan our meals well in advance. We also like the experiential shopping at farmers markets and other markets. Between Relay and markets, we avoid the conventional grocery stores as much as possible. Professor Tolbert, you're nodding like, yeah, that makes sense to you, given the trends that you know about.
Sure, absolutely. And the benefit is definitely for local commerce. But to answer your earlier question about how are we repurposing all of this retail space and where does it go and what becomes of it, this is a perfect example of how local retail space now becomes part of the delivery hub or the supply chain for people that want to go farm to table. So we're finding that the repurposing of this old retail space and local commerce is about convenience. It's about putting money back into the community and compressing the supply chain around things that are perishable. And so consumers are finding that not only to be easy access, but it gives them a little bit more control over their food supply. So in terms of grocery shopping, you do see an advantage that is beginning to rival what the larger chain grocery stores can provide. And it really is about the supply chain and the warehousing and the delivery benefits of local commerce.
We got an email from Kristen. I'm gonna read Kristen's question and then take a phone call. But I think all relates to these development questions. Kristen wrote us, "What's going on at the new Towson Row, which is under construction in the Towson proper area?" And Ray, calling us from Baltimore, has some other questions. I think about that same part of the region. Ray, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
And I live in the Owens Mills area, and I called because I heard you say that the last store closed in November. But that's not true because JCPenney is still open and is about to close if it hasn't closed already. Also, the information that you were talking about what's going to happen to the mall, like I said, I live in the community. We've heard absolutely nothing recently about any new development. We've been asking. We heard similar to what you said is supposed to happen to the Owens Mills development, but nothing has happened. And I heard that all plans got scrapped once they built the Wegmans.
Okay, let's see what Melody Simmons knows about this, Ray. Thanks for calling.
Well, Ray, I know there's a lot of concern in the community, but Kimco just purchased the majority ownership of that mall from General Growth Properties. So now, and they're working on purchasing the other properties as well. So soon, very shortly, when they go to settlement, and these things do take time because they're massive transactions, they will own the whole property. And they have said that they plan to begin the reconstruction or redevelopment of that area. As you mentioned, right around the corner is the Foundry Row development, which is going up at the old Solo Cup site on Reisterstown Road, anchored by a Wegmans with a lot of other retail, LA Fitness, LifeBridge Health, DSW Shoes. They're all signed leases to go in there, and that's going to start opening in the fall. And then also around the corner is Metro Center. So this area is really, really growing. Metro Center, of course, is tied in with the Metro. It's a transit-oriented development. It has retail, it has office, and it has residential. So that area within, say, a two-mile radius is just finally getting its 15 minutes of fame. It's going to be more than 15 minutes once it starts to open.
And you expect that to sort of come to fruition in a year?
It will start in the fall when Wegmans opens. I think when Wegmans opens up there on Reisterstown Road, that is going to be the beginning of a new chapter in that area, and that's going to spur the growth of and development over at the old mall. I think just because there's going to be so many people coming there, they're going to attract a lot of new retailers to the old mall site.
Ray, thanks for the call. Kristen's question about Towson Row.
Towson Row is just beginning construction. Towson is having its moment. There's Towson Row, Towson Square, Towson Circle, and Towson Triangle. So there's a lot of development going on up there.
Towson and, geometry.
Yes, indeed. And all of it is based on what we were saying about generational. It's really geared towards either the baby boomer era or baby boomers and millennials. And it has a lot of retail, a lot of residential, and it's pedestrian friendly. So you can see that right now. Bobby's Burger Palace just opened on Friday with Bobby Flay in there flipping burgers. So it's a really nice development, has the movie theater, and you walk up to it. So this is a new, a whole new development for Towson.
Professor Talbert, some stores that have been really successful online are now opening up physical stores. I mean, the eyeglass store Warby Parker just opened a store in Harbor East, and the New York Times did a piece yesterday about Amazon opening up physical bookstores, which must send shivers through the spines of the independent booksellers who are left. What's this trend about?
I think the trend is about really being able to capture the demand wherever consumers are. The Warby Parker was a pure play, strictly online, and we've had maybe two decades of purely online internet retailers who now realize that the sensory aspect of the customer experience cannot be solely recreated through a digital platform. So you find them going back into the store where people can feel, touch, and commune with other like consumers, because this social dimension of buying is prevalent across product categories and across generations. And so no one wants to not be where the consumer is at any given point in time. So you see us coming full circle in terms of understanding the benefits and the advantages of the physical space and closing the deal for consumers.
But are these stores essentially lost leaders then for the online commerce?
No, absolutely not. I think it's very symbiotic. And I think you capture the demand at different times for different reasons. Some of it can be driven by special occasions. Some of it can be driven, again, by social events. Some of it may be driven by lifestyle factors. So I think what retailers are trying to figure out, there isn't an either-or fit, is that all individuals at various points in time are shopping across channels. The goal and the solution is to be where they are and to be able to place an order once they make that decision to pull the plug.
So all individuals, so you're not seeing there are some people who gravitate to doing it online because it's fast and efficient and that fits their image of themselves, and there are some people who gravitate toward doing it all in the store because of all the social experiential things that you've talked about. Different people.
Correct.
Different times do it differently.
There are situational factors, and certainly there are individual differences in terms of personality factors that determine when and how we shop more consistently. But we all follow a different path to purchase across different product categories. So we step outside of our normal purchasing habits various times for various reasons. And we don't understand all of them, but if you don't have a physical environment where people can indeed engage and interact with the brand, you potentially miss a market that's very viable. And despite two decades of buying books and CDs online, a physical book retailer will thrive in this market and in these times, because people have still discovered that there's something about holding the physical product, flipping through the pages, and perusing all the other alternative options is a sensory experience for the book reader. And I think in every product category, an innovative retailer is going to find a way to extend that purchase decision in the physical environment, because it gives them another opportunity to sell to the customer.
In that interview about the Amazon's brick-and-mortar bookstore in Seattle, the reporter offered the opinion that part of what Amazon seems to be doing is not just selling books, but getting people comfortable with devices. Devices, which presumably those people will fill up at some point with ebooks.
Sure.
So it struck me as an interesting play by Amazon.
I think that's an interesting perspective, because we're finally getting to the point where we want to understand and connect with our retail partners in a different way. And so we've grown to trust them online, and we know the capabilities about Amazon online, but to further that, the purchasing power of that brand is to now get them to trust you in the physical space, that to bring you into the store to experience new products, to innovate and to collaborate with them in other ways that will ultimately extend your purchasing power with them. And that's another straight play for building customer loyalty and solidifying the consumer brand relationship for Amazon.
We need to take another short break here. When we come back, let's talk more about how stores are trying to hold our attention and draw us back. How do brands create a seamless customer experience from the physical store to the online platform? I'd love your ideas about this. You can join the conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast here in the studio with Melody Simmons and Sylvia Long-Talbert. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Melody Simmons, who covers development and real estate for the Baltimore Business Journal, is here with me in studio. So is Sylvia Long-Talbert, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, an expert on consumer behavior, marketing research, and brand management. We're talking about how we shop. How are malls and shopping centers adapting to today's customers? Customers who can shop at any moment online. We'd love to take your calls. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email to midday@wypr.org. I want to pick up where we were talking about Amazon in particular. One of the things that I guess, I mean, Amazon is known for mining all kinds of data on the online purchases. How does that What is that telling them about how to do in-store retail? And is that part of what online retailers in general do with their online experience? Does that change the data they get from that? Does that change how they do a brick-and-mortar store?
I believe it does from the perspective of inventory. What items are likely to move more quickly through a physical environment? They certainly have grounded insights about how to merchandise within the store, given the data that they accumulate online and people's purchase propensity, the frequency of purchase, sensitivity to price. So there are a lot of factors that will help them determine these are the items in the inventory selection that will sell best and keep foot traffic coming through the store. But you have to also wonder that their competitive booksellers have sustained themselves in the physical world for a reason. And I also imagine competitive insights from Barnes and Nobles further influence their decision to come back into, well, to go into the physical world and to provide a different type of in-store experience that is unique to the Amazon brand. Certainly their one-click shopping and the data, all the data information they have about your purchase history across product categories will give them some advantage that the independent bookseller will not have and Barnes and Noble will not have. And so that's where they have a clear advantage. They see your lifestyle factors and considerations from their database and are able to leverage that information, I think, in creating an in-store experience probably that's going to rival anything that we've seen so far in the 21st century.
Melody, when I think Amazon, bricks and mortar, I think of the big warehouse here in Baltimore.
Yes.
What kind of impact is that having on both e-commerce and just retail commerce?
It's rewriting the whole area and the genre here about how people shop. It is starting to. It just opened about a year and a half ago. It's over there on the east side off of Browning Highway. If you drive down that road, you won't believe your eyes. That whole area is having a rebirth, and it's all warehouse-based. It's a 24/7 operation. They are constantly delivering out of there. hop on 95, the trucks, especially at the Christmas time, they had to hire extra employees. And there are investors who have purchased the old industrial sites right across the street, torn down the plants there, and are building more and more warehouse space. So this is going to be the new e-commerce hub in the city. It's pretty amazing.
And so I realize a lot of things could happen in warehouse space besides order fulfillment for retail, but is that a lot of what's going to be going on there? We've been talking about people experiencing in stores, maybe purchasing online. Do these warehouses play into that?
They do. They also use the data that they get when you make an online purchase. Even if you're looking at a certain book, like if you're on Amazon looking up a book by Anne Lamott, then you're going to get a whole list of recommendations about what other books that Anne has written. You're going to get other books in that same genre. So it really kind of the cookies in the on the internet takes it and runs with the ball for you. If you're in a brick and mortar store, when you go to make your purchase, the sales clerk will say, do we have your name? Are you in our database? Can I have your email? This adds to a new and growing database that stores are keeping, which will help them to kick out coupons, notify of sales, or also keep shopping trends that you might not realize when you're making that purchase. So all this data is being collected now. I'm going to a convention in Las Vegas in May about shopping centers, and that's going to tell us, because this is a big topic of conversation in that profession right now, where do we go from here?
Professor Talbert, when we were talking a few minutes ago about customers making the decision perhaps while they're still in the store to get this or that item but in a different color or different size than is available right there in the store. And you're describing this incredibly quick decision that customers are making. And it crossed my mind, yeah, that only works if shipping is free, doesn't it? Are customers, or am I wrong, are customers willing to pay to get something delivered to them for all the other reasons they want it, or are people expecting this shipping free and in many cases right now sales tax free, because some retailers don't collect sales taxes? Is that what motivates people to be so quick to shop online?
I think for many that has been the motivation, is the free shipping is an incentive, and you know, with certain volume of purchases, you can waive the shipping. When you translate that concept to the physical store, I think you're going to find that to be a customer service value added benefit. If you're in the store and we don't have it, we'll automatically ship it to you at our cost, because it is in our system and we don't want to lose the sale. So you can see where the two channels could effectively compete with each other, which is something I think retailers would like to avoid. So I think the in-store experience is going to be competitive and a number of ways to draw people in. And some of these benefits may be we waive shipping on purchases that some people might otherwise pay shipping for if they were shopping at another company. But this integrated channel strategy will have to weigh and take that into consideration. But I imagine that retailers ultimately, in managing a supply chain across any channel, will figure out how to absorb the cost of free shipping to keep the people coming into the physical environment. And the people coming into the physical environment are an important component of creating the in-store experience. So we want the right mix of customers online and in the physical store, because that's what's going to draw people in, add to the uniqueness of the in-store experience, is the dynamic and diversity of the customers that come in as well.
Michael is calling us. I'm not sure from where. Michael, welcome to Midday.
I'm calling. I live in Baltimore. I just want to make a comment because I know that the focus of the talk is on, and discussion is on, commercial development and changes in it, but there was a comment about the Owings Mills area and its development, and there was a comment about the Metro Center, and the Metro Center was presented by one of your guests as, well, there's residences and there's businesses, and it's near this boundary and all that. Well, there's also a six-story Baltimore County Library and Community College of Baltimore County building, and that is used for classes, and there's hundreds upon hundreds of students who come to the library and come and study and take courses at the Community College of Baltimore County, all at that Metro Center. And I think that's part of a community's development to not just have residences and new stores and restaurants, but also have this wonderful educational center that counties, and I teach at the Community College of Baltimore County, so I'm quite familiar with that area, and so I just wanted to comment on that.
Michael, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Yes, I have been to that building, Michael, and it is absolutely gorgeous. The library itself is the largest in the system. The community college is brand new. I think everything opened a couple of years ago. I've had a tour. I've been out there quite some few times working on stories, and it has added such a cachet to that whole development because, like you say, it's transit-oriented. You can take the subway in. You can go to your classes. The library's there. You can get a coffee. You can get an apartment if you want to live out there if you like it so much. So it's very convenient in the suburbs.
Michael, thank you. Thank you for the call. I'm wondering whether any experience can be, any visit to a store can be turned into an experience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are so many dimensions of the in-store experience. For example, in a particular product category, how-to sessions, teaching you how to maximize the use or consumption of a product or service certainly can happen in the store. We see Ulta and Sephora actually use the in-store experience that way. Both of those brands have extensive websites and how-to videos on YouTube, and it keeps you abreast of the fashion trends around cosmetic. But you will find those stores are continuously filled with patrons who are coming in to master their techniques, to really talk to experts, and to add some value to the usage experience for the cosmetics arena. You see where Williams-Sonoma has built out the in-store experience with cooking classes and finding other ways to help consumers actually utilize and maximize the value of the manufactured products. There is a store in New York called This Is Story, and it has revolutionized the brand experience. And what it does every 6 to 8 weeks is switch out the merchandising experience for a particular brand. A company will pay them almost $500,000 or so to do nothing but merchandise the store around the brand experience. And so the young lady that started that concept, that retail concept, has found a way to continuously build out innovative experiences that present the brand in a new light. So this is where retailers are challenged to innovate, and to understand what brings the brand experience to life for a customer segment. So I think there is no limit on how you integrate digital platforms, electronics, technology, and apps to really build out an experience that is in the moment, it's dynamic, and it's constantly meeting people's needs as pop culture and industries evolve.
We have just a minute left, and I want to just briefly raise a question from Monica that goes to the competence of retailers. She says, in her experience, some stores have poor inventory management. Walmart.com cannot reliably tell you what inventory in any particular store from their website. But on the other hand, Target.com is generally very reliable. What does this tell us about where this trend is going?
I think it shows us that you can shop online and pick up in the store. That a lot of time is that option is offered. If you want to buy a backpack and you see Target.com has it, and they'll say, do you want to get in the store or do you want us to ship it to you? So that is going on right now. And I think this is something that stores have to do to step it up a little bit to keep the consumers happy, because they'll just go right on down the line to the next store, the next website. It's competition.
I think we have to leave it there. I want to thank you both. This has been a really interesting conversation. Sylvia Long Talbert is assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, and Melody Simmons covers real estate and development for the Baltimore Business Journal. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I also want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch today for midday guests. The DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo crab cakes. The DIS is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at thedisbaltimore.com. And I want to thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We plan to zero in on one of the big issues in the campaign for mayor of Baltimore, tax breaks for developers, TIFs. That's tomorrow on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.